super strong, supernatural, and super bad. His punch can topple a skyscraper. His kick can split the earth in two. More destructive than an earthquake, mightier than a tidal wave. A one-man disaster area.
42nd Street Pete.
Shot full of lead and he still ain't dead. Jump back, Jack, for your skull is cracked.
42nd Street Pete.
Okay, it's Saturday night. It's the Grindhouse, and we had a lot of people request our guest tonight back. So without further ado, let's get into it. Tonight, we're fortunate enough to have back with us again, writer, actor, stuntman, and all-around great guy, Gary Kent. Welcome back to the Grindhouse.
Thank you very much, Pete. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor to be here.
Oh, thank you. You know, you had sent me a film in the mail that was released in 86, I believe, as L.A. Bad, and you just re-released it as Rainy Day Friends. And I didn't know what to expect, and this is one of the few films, you know, I'm not stroking you because we're friends or anything like that, but I put this thing on, and I was, like, mesmerized, and I couldn't shut it off.
Oh,
wow. It was probably one of the most intense things I've ever seen, and I honestly think it's more pertinent today than it was back in 86 because it deals a lot with the medical profession and hospitals and how they treat people who are on their way out or have cancer and stuff. And I really related to it in a big way because I went through a lot of the things that they had, you had shown in the film. And I'm curious to see, how did you pick that as a subject?
It began here in Austin, Texas. I was looking around for something to write. I'd just moved here, my wife and I, and we were living sort of out in the country, and I was looking around for something to write about, and there was an article in the New York Times newspaper, my wife was reading it, about a kid that was living in a car that had died, and he was living in the car because he was unruly and his folks didn't want him in the house. And she said, why don't you write something about this? So I thought, I don't really want to write about somebody that died, but that's an interesting premise. Why was he living in the car? What was it? And from there, guys, I just did the typical writer's thing. You know, what if? What if he didn't die? What if he was an illegal? And I started playing with that, and it came up. And in L.A., I had been coaching some football for young kids, and I would take them to the cancer ward, the children's cancer ward, and say, hey, you want to see some really tough guys and girls, let's go to the cancer ward and check out these people. So I had kind of that idea in mind anyway, how tough these people are that fight that illness and how bad the medical system is. And I mean, it still is. We still get the runaround for so many people. But that's kind of how the idea germinated.
Yeah, it's like L.A. Bad doesn't really do the film justice because it comes across as more like a gang film, but you know, just as a whole character study and, you know, just as a celebration of life and just everything like that. And just like you say, to show really how bad the medical profession was and, just so many standout performances in that film. S.A. Morales, I remember I had seen him, you know, he was first coming up in Bad Boys and La Bamba. And I said, my mother even said to me, because she had seen La Bamba, and she says, that kid's going to go somewhere someday and, you know, Look where he is now.
Yeah. I am so so lucky to have gotten his eye for that part. As a matter of fact, the title L.A. Bad was the distributor who bought the film and was releasing it. Actually, it did pretty well around the world under that title, L.A. Bad, but it was a terrible title. And I fought like mad not to, because originally I wrote it as Rainy Day Friends. These two guys, the ex-fighter pilot and the young Mexican kid, bond at the hospital, as you know. And I thought, okay, they're the Rainy Day Friends. That happens a lot in life. We get some friend that helps us through those really bad times where the fair weather friends kind of run away. That was my idea anyway. But the distributor changed it to L.A. Bad, which is a terrible title. It has nothing to do with L.A. Bad. So when people started asking me, after my book came out, people started saying, where can I get a DVD? And again, I didn't have one. So I thought, well, we'll just do one. So my buddies and I, some filmmakers here in Austin, went ahead and put together a DVD under the original title.
And they can get that strictly from you now, right?
Right, right. www.GaryWarnerKent, W-A-R-N-E-R, GaryWarnerKent.com. If you just go there or go to the marketplace, under that's my website, there it'll be, and the trailer and the whole backstory on it.
You know, I can't urge people enough to check this one out because, you know, I'm sure everybody listening and, you know, all of us have had to deal with cancer in one way, shape, or form, and it's not a wonderful thing to deal with. And like I said, it struck home with me because, you know, I had prostate cancer, and, you know, simple thing. Well, they go, well, you know, you had three choices. I didn't want to go radiation. I didn't want to go seeding. I'm like, you know, all right, I think I was 55. I said, I've sown enough wild oats, take it out. So
yeah.
It's all robotics, and, you know, they sell you a bill of goods in retrospect. And
yeah.
I went for it, and I wound up having complications, and I wound up on a cancer floor for 10 days. And I can't say it was in the worst 10 days of my life, but it was definitely in the top 10. And just as you depicted in you know, the film, they don't give a shit about you. They leave you. You're sitting there pushing the buzzer for hours. I mean, not so much me, but my roommate was in really bad shape. And, like, I told the one nurse, because it was an incident where basically I was left in my own debris. You know, they didn't give a shit. And my mother, who actually was a graduate of the school from that hospital, had come over to see me. And when she saw the shape I was in, she stormed down to, you know, the powers that be and raised hell. And, you know, they came in and they were Q&A-ing me. And I said, well, we dread, you know, when it gets dark because, you know, the day shift is great because they're supervised. The night shift, they didn't give a shit. And as you depicted, it was very true to life, and it really hit home for me. And I can't urge people enough to check this thing out because things haven't changed, you know?
No, they haven't. And in some ways, they've gotten maybe a little worse. When I did the film, even though it deals with cancer, because you're a walking testimonial of it, cancer can be beaten. And I remember not too long ago where I went to a charity event in Los Angeles, and I was sitting at a table talking with several writers, and this one woman was talking about a book that had just come out, Cancer is Metaphor. And the metaphor was for death. If you had cancer, that meant death. So it's like a dirty word if you've got cancer. But people survive cancer a lot, mainly because of their own tenaciousness of fighting it and sticking with it and looking for ways to cure it. So I thought, well, I want to do this film about people who beat it. And also, you know me, guys, I had to stick in some stunts. It won Best Special Stunt in a Motion Picture for that year. It beat out Beverly Hills Cop, as a matter of fact. And I put stunts and music and everything else I could throw in there that I thought would help it be more uplifting than just a film about illness or death. And I hope it worked.
Oh, it did open with a great stunt. That whole, you know, dragging, you know, what was that, like, had to be four or five blocks, I would think.
Yeah. We did. We wore out 11 sets of clothes on the stunt guy. Spiro Rosato, I directed, of course, and designed the stunt, but Spiro Rosato, who's a great stuntman, did the actual drag. And Isai got in and did, you know, the close-ups, dragging him around. But we went through 11 different uniforms, sets of clothes, dragging Spiro around the streets of L.A. and out on that freeway.
Yeah, that was a great way to open it up. And, you know, again, you had a great cast. I mean, John Philip Law is the doctor, and he was being icy cold. And
yeah.
Chuck Bale was Smiling Jack. I mean, he epitomized what I would think Smiling Jack would look like.
You know, Chuck's kind of that way in real life. That's kind of Chuck. He's very much like that, just a big old tough guy who can fly anything, drive anything. You know, so I thought I was waiting around forever for James Caan to say yes or no to that part. And it was when James was going through some of his, you know, problems in his own life, and he just couldn't make up his mind between mine or five or six other scripts, and I waited forever and said, that's it, I got to find someone. All of a sudden, my wife said, how about Chuck Mayo, who was a good friend of mine? And I thought, gee, you know what, Chuck's perfect for the part. So that's how he ended up in it, Pete.
Yeah, he was in the Stuntman Hall of Fame, isn't he?
Yeah. Stuntman's Hall of Fame, and he was one of the original founders of the Stuntman's Association, he and Bobby Hoy. So he goes way back.
Yeah, and like you had said in your book that, you know, stunt people just don't get their due. You know, they have the Academy Awards for every other, you know, makeup, you know, hairdressing, gaffer, all kinds of other crap. But, you know, never for the people who really put it all out there on the line, which is a shame.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. The whole idea, of course, of doing stunts is you want the audience to think it's the real guy doing it, the real actor, but in all honesty, there are damn few of them that can really do the stunts, and not only that, they shouldn't do them, because if they get hurt, then it hurts the production, but you know, the production would have to shut down and wait for them to heal or replace them. But that very thing of if a stuntman gets hurt, they just say, okay, get him off the set and bring in another stuntman. I mean, it's that callous almost. And these guys put it on the line, guys and girls, all the time for film. And they really don't get their due. You know, they don't really get, there's no award for it. Although we have the Stuntman Awards now, we do our own award show. But yeah, the Academy just doesn't want to admit we exist.
Yeah, they were like that with special effects makeup for the longest time, too. They just didn't acknowledge it until, I think it was Rick Baker with, I'm trying to think. Might have been, I think it was Greystoke, wasn't it? Or am I wrong?
You know, I'm not sure. Was it Todd?
Todd, are you still there or did you fall asleep? Todd leave?
I think Todd went out for brew.
No, he doesn't drink.
Oh, okay.
Maybe he had a, I don't know. Well, we could talk over him. It's no big deal.
Greystoke, you know, that could have been. That could have been. That I was so. About time.
Yeah. Because Rick Baker is really good with the, he loves to do the gorilla stuff. That seems to be a specialty.
Yeah, yeah. Man, they're just some great special effects makeup people, too. I learned so much from those guys. Some of the secrets of doing that stuff is amazing.
Yeah, now they're being phased out with the CGI.
CGI, it just makes me sick. I can tell. What's the new, Lucas has a new movie out about the Black Squadron during the Second World War. I forget the name. The Tuskegee Airmen.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah.
But I'm watching the trailer for, and it's just all CGI. I thought, this is terrible. I can tell every shot. You know, there's nothing real in it. And it just bothers me. I guess maybe the kids today, Pete, don't mind it. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that they're more into it because it's sort of like we were having a discussion one time. I don't know if you know a guy named Keith Crocker. He's a horror writer, and he has a website and stuff, and he made a couple low-budget exploitation movies, and he called it right. They have a video game mentality. Something has to be happening every 5 seconds or they lose interest.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, you're right.
I've met people that can't watch black and white films. They're in their 20s.
Really?
Yeah, they just don't get it.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it's sad.
It is sad. And I know people, you probably do too, who are watching movies today on their Blackberries or their iPods or whatever. They're watching a whole movie on it. And I'm going, you're watching a movie on something the size of a deck of cards? How can that be?
I don't get it either. I mean, one of my, you know, guilty pleasures, I had to buy a big screen TV to watch my stuff on because, you know, that's the way you're supposed to see certain stuff.
Absolutely.
But these, I can't understand this. Even internet TV and stuff like that, you get the YouTube thing, you get a small, I'm like, what the hell? I mean, I'm getting old. I can't see this stuff.
Yeah, me either. And I don't know if the kids today really realize what a magic event going to a movie used to be, good or bad or whatever, just the whole idea of going to a theater and sitting there with a bunch of other people and that curtain opening and the screen being bigger than life. Well, you can just lose yourself in it. It's very hard for me to lose myself into a computer.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, I basically grew up in the grindhouse and the drive-ins and stuff. And actually, one of the last films I did see in a theater was something you were involved with. I think you broke your leg on it, though, was Bubba Hotep.
Yeah. Oh, I'll be darned. Yeah. I did break my leg on it, but I thought it was a good movie. What did you think?
Oh, I thought it was great. I mean, I didn't understand what the whole premise was, and somebody goes, oh, you've got to see this. And I'm like, all right, you know, I like Bruce Campbell, I like Ozzie Davis, I like Reggie, you know, I like the Phantasm movies that Don did, so I figured out how bad could it be. I'm like, wow, talk about over the top and great. I mean, who the hell would have bought the fact Ozzie Davis playing JFK? Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Don's got a new movie now that he just got into Sundance called John Dies at the End, and it's a great film. I've seen it, and it just really, really works. So he's still at it. He tried to get another Bubba going, but arguments with Warner Brothers and over contracts and money or whatever, and it just didn't work out. So he just went out and made another sort of low budget on his own, and it's so good it got accepted at Sundance right away.
That's good. I always liked Don's stuff.
Yeah, yeah, me too. He's a great guy.
Yeah. He's one of those guys that didn't really whore himself out to the majors and just sell out completely, like some other people I won't mention. But
I hear you. I hear you.
It's sad. There's, you know, as you know, a film buff, there ain't too much for me to look forward to. You know, as far as things out there, you know, they're saying this other devil thing is supposed to be good, Devil Inside or something. You're giving that a lot of push.
Yeah, I've heard. I'm not sure what I heard about that, but it is supposed to be good. It's making a lot of noise anyway.
Yeah, it'd be nice to have something that scared you instead of grossed you out or insulted your intelligence. That's all I've seen lately.
I don't know if you saw or remember a movie called Targets with Boris Karloff.
Oh, yeah. That was a great film.
I was the... I acted in it, but I also did all the special effects, which in that case meant all the shooting. And my granddaughter came to visit from California over the holiday, the New Year holiday, and we threw a dinner at some friend's place. And the friend that film was loosely based on the Texas Tower incident, where Charlie Whitman, you know, up on the tower, shot all the students back in the '90s. In the '60s, and many people at the dinner that we threw had been students at the time that happened. And so I thought, well, I'll play Targets for them and see what they think. It blew them away. I mean, it just brought back all of a sudden all these tales of what happened that day, what they remembered went on that day. And Polly Platt, who was Peter Bogdanovich's wife at the time, co-wrote the script and the original story. And she was a student at UT when that happened. So everybody had their favorite horror story of what happened that particular day. I don't know if you remember an actor, writer, guy named Robert Burns. He did Diary of a Serial Killer and several other things. And he was the art director on Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original. He was a buddy of mine here in Austin. But he was a student that day at UT when it happened. He said he was walking across campus, and there was a lot of construction going on. So you were always hearing planks drop and stuff. And he would hear this plank sound, and he thought it was construction guys dropping things. But he had his eyes on this young girl that was walking across campus in white short shorts. And he thought, man, she's really a fox. And all of a sudden he heard a plank drop, and this big red stain appeared on her white shorts, and she just fell down. And he thought, what is going on? And some guy ran over and huddled over her, and all of a sudden he got shot. And that's when Bob realized somebody's shooting people. And he ran in the student union building and said, don't go out. Somebody's shooting people. Don't go out. And, of course, everyone immediately went outside to see what was going on. But what a thing that must have been.
Yeah, that's... I remember the movie was loosely based on that. He climbed the... I think the spot you were talking about, too, was when he was shooting the cars on the highway. That was one of the spots that you did, right?
Right. It's very funny because we were watching it, and I was up on the tower doing the shooting for the kid that was playing the killer, shooting at the cars, and then I would go down and get in a car and drive on the freeway and act like I was taking the hit and get out and run down the side of the freeway and get shot. So, in essence, I was shooting myself, so to speak. And the side story is, Pete, we didn't have any permits. And, of course, you're just not supposed to shoot on a freeway no matter what. And here were all these cars coming along, and they saw me pull, swerve over to the side of the road and get out and run along. I was dressed as a woman, and all of a sudden fall over on the road bank. They immediately, people start calling the police, and the police came, and Peter and the whole camera crew disappeared. So the cops were telling me and Don Jones, who was doing some of the stunts with me, what did you guys think you were doing? We said, we're doing a movie. There's the crew. And we turned around, and, of course, there was nobody. And we got our licenses suspended for 6 months for doing that. But it worked. We got the shot.
Yeah. Wow. How was it? Did you ever get a chance to work with Boris on that?
Yeah. What a nice guy Boris was. He was pretty ill at the time. He was on his, sort of his last legs. But, in fact, it may have been his last movie or almost his last movie. But we had lunch a couple of times. We sat out there and talked and had lunch. And he was telling me about his roses. He raised championship roses. He got a lot of awards for his horticulture. And also he raised Bedlington Terriers, a special breed of dog. And he was more proud of those two things than anything. He just went on and on about his roses and his dogs. So, yeah, a nice guy, Boris Karloff.
Yeah, that's what I had heard. I also said a lot of people said that Targets was probably the best thing he had ever done toward the end. He was on his last legs. I think the thing that may have contributed to his demise is he did that one movie in England, probably after Targets, Curse of the Crimson Altar, which was released over here as The Crimson Cult. And
I didn't see that.
I had heard he caught a chill, and he was frail to begin with. So
because
Sid Haig was actually supposed to work with him on those things they shot. They shot part of it in Mexico and part of it in Los Angeles toward the end of his life.
Yeah,
he was supposed to work with him, and that never happened. It was a big thing about Boris getting sick. So
too bad. You know, so many of the, you know this as well as I do, so many of those great old actors, the great ones, were such gentlemen, and they never showed up with an entourage and bodyguards and, you know, five or six people, you know, pushing their way through the set to get into the set. There was just something very grand about them that I really, and gentlemanly about them that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, you're lucky you got a chance to work with a bunch of them, too.
Yeah. Very, very lucky. So how do you like being out of the great East Coast?
Oh, it's great. It's like stress levels down to like nothing, you know, no problems, you know, just trying to figure out what my next move is as far as making a living. But other than that, you know, it's cool. There's no... There honestly wasn't anything I could do out there. You know, it wasn't going to be cost prohibitive anyway. So I figured, you know, you may as well, you know, make the move while you can make it. And, you know, the deal was good. So I did it.
Sure. Sure. I hear you. So you're writing now, aren't you? Doing some writing again?
I'm going to try to finish the book I was working on or been working on. I'm just trying to do some catch up with everything, you know.
But,
yeah, I'm going to get back into that. A lot of people emailed me about your book, how much they enjoyed it.
Oh, man. I so appreciate you doing that show with me. It helped a lot. I made some good sales from that. So I owe you dinner, Pete, next time I see you.
Yeah. No, my pleasure. I mean, I just was, you know, skimming through it again just to bone up on a few things, you know, for tonight. But it's still, what a great book.
You know, every... At least once or twice a week, I get a phone call from somebody or an email from somebody that just read the book. And I don't know if you remember Mike Haynes or not. He was a stunt guy, and he also a good-looking guy. He was the Winchester man back when the Winchester guy rode up on his horse smoking Winchester cigarettes. That was Mike Haynes, and he was president of the International Stuntmen's Association. Anyway, I hadn't talked to him for 20 years, and I just got a phone call from him. He's in Louisiana now, and he said, "Hey, I just got your book and read it. It's really great, blah, 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 blah." But to make a long story short, he's living down there, and he's putting together a movie he wants to do about a killer crocodile. So I thought, maybe that hasn't been done. Maybe, why not?
No, they've done a lot of killer crocodile movies, and being that I'm one of those guys that marks out for reptiles in general, I always wind up buying them and then, like, been ready to gouge my eyes out with pencils after the movie ends. They're just so... Every once in a while, you hit a good one.
Yeah.
Actually, the best one I ever saw, I think it was shot in Texas, the one John Sayles wrote, Alligator, with
Alligator.
Yeah.
I never saw it, so it was good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, the old alligator in the sewer trick, you know?
Ah.
Tongue-in-cheek, I think it's an animatronic alligator. It's a pretty big, good-looking alligator, too.
Hmm.
Pretty good cast.
I love that movie.
Oh, you're back. But,
I'm still. I've been here.
Where did you go?
Did you holler for me? I've been here.
No, you weren't here. Don't. Gary can witness this. Okay.
I was here.
Bullshit! You weren't here. You left for some. He said you went out for a short one, and I go, you don't drink. You went out for something.
Oh, I took my headphones off for a minute so I could go over to the other machine. That might have been when you asked me something.
Okay.
Sorry, guys.
All right. We're gonna forgive you, Todd. I don't know though.
Yeah.
I still think you went to the local pub for a couple of big ones. But Pete tells me you don't drink. So
no,
that's... Anyway, guys, this alligator thing that Mike Haynes wants to do in Louisiana is about the Second World War. They were developing, you know, how they had dolphins go down and do sonar or whatever. So they decided to develop an alligator that would be a weapon, a dangerous weapon. So they worked on this killer alligator that would kill the enemy. And then the war ended and whatever, and they said, hey, we don't need it. Forget it. We'll go on to something else. So the old man that was working on the thing, developing this alligator, left his directions for making the alligator, how you would do it. He left it in his safe, and then he died. And years later, his grandson finds it and regenerates this killer alligator. That's the story, anyway. So we'll see. He wants Chuck Bale and I to come down and do it, you know, for $3 and a bologna sandwich from the old days. I don't know.
There's been a lot of alligator movies out lately. That was the one, Primeval, that was supposedly based on fact, though. Talking about big crocodile, where, you know, in the river where they're having, you know, revolutions where they dump the bodies, so it develops a taste for people, so.
Oh, I see, yeah.
As long as you don't use CGI, it'll be great. Tell them as long as they make an actual rubber monster, people will love it. But everyone's so tired of that fake-looking cartoon stuff.
Yeah, we were just talking about that. I'm so fed up with it. The new George Lucas movie, The Tuskegee Airmen, is out, and it's just CGI the entire way, and it just bothered the hell out of me. I had to walk. But a lot of the kids today don't care. You know, as Pete said, they're used to the video games, and they're used to that kind of look, so it doesn't bother them to see a movie that's all CGI.
You know what I saw, and this had a couple of good stunts in it, too, and I was actually pretty surprised. This movie called Faster, and it has The Rock in it, Dwayne Johnson.
And
Billy Bob Thornton's one of the characters in it. It wasn't bad. I was really surprised. It was an R-rated one instead of a Disney one, and, you know, The Rock was pretty sadistic in this thing.
You know, he can be pretty damn good, The Rock.
Yeah.
Pretty damn good for an ex-wrestler ball player. He's not bad at all.
Nah, he got out when the getting was good before he fucked himself up totally.
Yeah. Absolutely. Pretty smart guy, too, from what I hear. I know a couple of buddies of his, and they say he's got it pretty together business-wise, so that's good.
Yeah, he made it in there, and he just, I guess he was smart enough to, you know, really get out before, you know, well, you know the business. You get a couple bad injuries, you know, like Mick Foley, you know, just hobbling around still.
Yeah.
It's a shame, but, you know, everybody takes those, you know, it's like stunts. People take, you know, I think we can work this out if we map it out. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't.
So. Sometimes it doesn't, and something just goes wrong. And, well, look at Dar Robinson, who was probably one of the best stuntmen ever, one of the best high men ever, and he just bought it much too young. He was just doing sort of a pass-by with some other guys on motorcycles and lost his bike and went over the side of the road and got impaled on a rock. And this was, you know, just one of those flukes. Never should have happened.
But yeah, was he actually doing a stunt, or was this just a motorcycle accident?
It was a motorcycle accident. They were just doing run-bys until they were getting ready to do the stunt work. So they were out just racing up and down the road and going around a couple of curves, and he just lost his bike over the side, and that was it. Most stunt guys, as you probably know, specialize in several things, and very few of them do everything. Like in the old days, we just had to do everything. So Dar wasn't really a great biker. He was a huge high fall guy and could just do anything up in the air, way, way up in the air, and fights and car work, so on and so forth. But motorcycles were not his bag. So he'd done it before, but he just wasn't that handy on a bike. And of course, anything can happen, no matter how handy you are. It can go wrong.
Actually, Dar was in the stunt. If anybody does would like to see what Dar would do, the best example I could give is Lethal Weapon 1. He takes the fall through the elevator shaft at the end and gets hung up on the rope.
Yeah, that's Dar. Isn't that a great stunt? Yeah. Dar Robinson. One of the best stunt guys, Alan Gibbs, could do anything, high falls, bike work, so on and so forth. And we were just talking about cancer. Alan Gibbs died like at age 42, one of the best stunt guys, could just defy death constantly, but he couldn't beat the Big C. It just got him. So you never know, man. I don't want to get maudlin here, but you just never know.
No, that's why I say, you know people, you know, be tight with them and keep in touch with them, because I just went through this thing before Christmas. A friend of mine, luckily I got over to see him, Thanksgiving. And he didn't look too good then, and he was telling me all this stuff. His kidneys had failed, and then, you know, another more medical bullshit. The shunt got infected. It went into his heart, messed up a valve. They had to do open heart surgery. Well, called him up 2 days before Christmas to find out he'd been cremated 2 days prior to that. I'm like, holy shit.
Wow.
You never know. You never know. That's why.
Yeah, you don't. And some of the old guys are still just like Richard Rush, who directed Free and the Bean. Yeah, and The Stuntman, one of my favorite films. Yeah, good buddy of mine, Richard, has had a heart transplant where for the last 10 years he's been walking around with someone else's heart in him. And he's about 84 and talking about getting ready to do another movie. So what can I say?
You know, sometimes it's just the luck of the draw.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. How long ago was it's none of my business, but was your incident with prostate cancer?
About 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know Bud Cardos, who directed, stunt guy directed Kingdom of the Spiders in the Dark? And
had the worst wig and the worst skull cap in the history of Western civilization. Sadist.
I'm going to tell him you said that.
Okay.
Yeah, Bud just got over being treated for prostate cancer. That's why I asked. He said for about a couple of years he was pretty sick with it. He did do the radiation, and he said it just made him very, very sick. It was like having needles in his scrotum all the time.
Yeah, that's why I said, you know, they were giving me the options, and it's like I didn't have to go for any chemo and shit. But, you know, what really happened was I wound up getting a blood clot, and it took out my left lung. So
yeah.
That was the fuck up on that whole deal. So,
yeah,
I don't even have any medical insurance anymore. This is another weird thing too, because you can't go from state to state. I have no clue what they're doing, but Jersey was sucky anyway. So I got up here, and every time I talk to somebody, they go, "Well, you have to be cancer free for 10 years before we can insure you." And I'm like, "It isn't like I still have it." So I'm like, you know something? I go to a chiropractor. I go for acupuncture. You know, whatever. I'm not going to sweat it.
Yeah, I tried to address some of those things in the film, although it was made years ago. They're really paramount now, this whole health thing. And medical marijuana, the use of medical marijuana is still like a real no-no here in Texas. Whereas in California, you can go down to Venice, just go up and down the sidewalk, and there are medical marijuana dispensers everywhere. Mm. But here, it's still like, man, if you do medical marijuana, you must be a crazed druggie. even if you've got cancer and it does help with nausea. I don't care what they say. It does help, but
they're
not going to allow it.
The sad part of it is that, you know, that could help create a lot of jobs in other sectors, and, you know, what people don't realize what a beneficial plant it really is, aside from the obvious, you know, hemp, rope, oil, clothing, paper, whatever. Matter of fact, the Declaration of Independence is written on hemp.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole thing was, it was never written out as a drug until, I think, the 70s, they said, because it was originally attached to a rider on a bill because of DuPont with the nylon and Hearst with the paper.
Yeah.
That's how they knocked it out. Then all of a sudden, people get high off this stuff, too. We can't have that shit either, you know? So.
No, we can't have people getting feeling good.
Yeah, I know.
For Christ's sake, unless they pay for it through a prescription of some kind.
Yeah, well, like I said, you're from California originally. Did they have the medical there before you left?
No. Although I think I show Isai in the movie sitting in his room smoking pot when I went over to the children's hospital. I was walking down the wards where they had the older kids, 16, 17, 18 years old, and man, I could smell pot in the corridor. And so I asked the nurse about it, and she said, yeah, we sort of turned our back on that. And she said the real problem wasn't the pot. They sort of allowed that to happen, but it was all the preachers that came in and started telling people they were dying and should confess their sins
before
they died, you know. Who were
you had that
creep
too. Yeah.
Stuck that in there. My buddy John Parker played that preacher, did a good job.
Yeah,
so it was going on, although it was really not talked about. It was just something you didn't mention at all.
You know, I don't think anybody tried to come in and save me when I was in there.
Ah.
Damn, they must have known better.
Yeah, I don't think you're savable, Pete.
No.
Me either.
How many people get kicked off of Facebook for dumb shit, you know, besides me?
Yeah.
You know what that whole thing was about?
I
got froze out. I was screwing around because I just bought out a video store when I went to Jersey. A friend of mine got in trouble, so he loaded my car up with stuff, and most of it was porn anyway. And I found this gay DVD that said Twink Blood on it instead of True Blood. So I'm like, all right, I put that up. There was nothing really explicit, and I said, this is the real True Blood. Well, they pulled it off, but then 3 weeks later, they suspended me for like 4 days.
Wow.
That's the reason. That's why I went on one of my tirades. I don't think I'm coming back to this fucking site anymore. And then Todd got something, too. Something happened with Todd. They shut him down for a while or did something.
What happened, Todd?
Yeah, it was the same kind of thing. Someone tried to turn me in for the same thing that they turned Pete in for. They were saying that I was spamming them, but I hadn't even asked anyone to be my friend in 2 weeks, and the only friend things that I even had were people who had like requested me or had someone send them to me. So I don't know what the heck they were even talking about.
Yeah. I don't know either. I disappeared for a couple of days, and I never knew why, and then all of a sudden I was back again. And I thought, well, what did I do?
Yeah. The thought police were checking it out. Okay.
Yeah. Hey, Todd, what's the hot film in Missouri? What's everybody going to see?
Whatever piece of talentless Rob Schneider crap is at the multiplex.
Oh, man. Yeah.
That's the Missouri wavelength, man. It's just really strange.
Doesn't his new show debut tonight?
Unfortunately, yes.
Rob Schneider. Not one of my favorites, I got to tell you.
No, it's bad.
But there was some stupid movie on Big Stan where he was in prison or something, and David Carradine had trained him to be a martial artist while he was chain smoking his ass off.
And
looked like a lot of the prisoners were former UFC. I saw Don Fry and I saw Randy Couture in there, so a lot of UFC guys were prisoners.
Wow.
That was a little bit amusing because Carradine was completely out of his mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chain smoking sensei. At one point, he's got Snyder holding up like two huge buckets full of cigarette butts or something as an exercise thing. Yeah. I was mildly amused with that.
You know, I worked with his old man, John Carradine, on a picture called The House of Seven Corpses. And it was very funny because he, after work, he would go right to the bar. And he was, of course, it was a dry state. We shot it in Utah, but you could bring your own bottle into the bar and they would sell you 7-Up or whatever. So he would go right to the bar. And he would sit there and chew tobacco and talk and drink. But he would spit the tobacco. There are no spittoons anymore. And he would just spit right on the floor in the bar. And we'd be talking away, and he would just, you know, bite off a chunk and just spit out on the floor and continue his one of 80 million stories he had to tell. I kind of liked the old fellow.
Oh, he was great. Here's a guy that would do, you know, some, you know, A-list movies and then do this grade Z schlock.
Yeah. Yeah, he did some great stuff. Grapes of Wrath would be one. And,
yeah.
I remember a movie called Swamp Water or Swamp Fire, some Dana Andrews?
Yeah, Swamp Fire, I think it was, yeah.
Yeah, great movie.
Yeah.
Again, we're talking black and white, man.
Yeah, yeah. And he was Count Dracula in those two Universal Monster Mash movies.
Yeah.
There's another guy. He worked right up until the end. He was always doing something.
Yeah, and what a memory he had. He could get, you know, 8 pages of dialogue the night before and go to his room, and the next morning he had it down tight, you know, no problem. He just had one of those memories, photographic memory.
Whatever happened to House of Seven Corpses?
You know, I did a Lars Nielsen, who's with the Alamo Theater chain here in Austin, nice guy, great exhibitor, called me and said that an English company had bought House of Seven Corpses and were doing a DVD of it, and they wanted him and I to do a commentary on the movie. I was the production manager on it, and everyone else that was on it was, like, dead. So I said, sure, I'll do it. So we went down, watched the movie, and did this great commentary, and then I don't know what happened to it. I never saw a DVD. I was supposed to get a copy. Didn't happen. I don't know what happened to it.
Because I don't think anybody really owned the rights to that thing. It was floating around on all those public domain labels.
Yeah. It wasn't a great movie, but it was fun. Yeah. And again, it had some of those great people in it, like Carradine and John Ireland.
Was Faith Demer?
Yes, Faith was in it.
Yeah,
what a gal she was.
Yeah, I know what I meant to ask you the last time, and it completely slipped my mind. You worked on Dracula vs. Frankenstein, the Al Adamson film.
Right.
Do you remember Angela Rizzito on that film?
Yeah, sure I do. Yeah, great guy, funny guy. He's one of my son's heroes. My son used to, when he was a kid, go up to Hollywood Boulevard and haunt the movie memorabilia shops and stuff. And he was always running into Angela Rizzito, who had a job hawking papers. When he wasn't acting, he was selling papers on some street corner there.
I think it was Sunset Boulevard or something, wasn't it?
Yeah. But a funny guy, and he would carry around a little valise with him all the time, a little suitcase. And when he would get on a bus, he would put that suitcase on and stand on that so he could get up on the seat to ride the bus. That was his stepping stone, so to speak.
Yeah, here's another guy. Oh, Todd's a big fan of his, too. He loves Angelo. He was working up until his 80s, I believe.
Yes, sir, and he did a lot of stuff.
Thunderdome, that was the last thing he did, I think.
Was it?
Beyond Thunderdome. Yeah, that was a rough part for him, too, because he was getting manhandled a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it was, but a nice guy, and he just kept working and working and working and working.
He was in the original Freaks, and then he was doing a lot of those low-budget Monogram, I think it was, it had to be Monogram with Lugosi in the 40s.
Yeah, you know, my first foray into Hollywood, I was looking to rent an apartment. I went to this apartment building, I forget where it was, and went up and knocked on the door from the manager. It said manager. The door opened, and it was Bela Lugosi. and he was the manager of the apartment. They didn't have any vacancies, but that was my intro to Hollywood. I thought, man, wow, this is cool.
And he was managing the apartment complex? Wow.
Yeah, he was managing Lugosi. And then the next thing I saw is I went to Sears, and there was a guy shopping in his pajamas. And I thought, this is my kind of place.
I was trying to track down that film you were looking for, too. You're saying that you had a great fight scene, The Lash of Lust or something, but I'm having no luck.
Yeah, man, I've got people even in Canada. A guy in Canada, Andrew Lapointe, found an advertisement for it somewhere, but, you know, a one sheet or something, but no DVD or VHS, anything available. So
I would think Sam Sherman would have it, wouldn't he?
Sam Sherman said he had an argument and a fight with the guy that financed it. Sam didn't finance it. I forget who did, and he had a fight with him. So when I mentioned Lash of the Lost, Sam didn't even want to talk about it.
Because I'm trying to think. I found out. Was that Al Adamson, the director?
Al Adamson directed it, only he used a different name. I forget what name he used. But, yeah, Al directed it. And Sam said it was his idea, that he came up with the idea on an airplane and sort of put it down. But this other guy, a guy named Marty Rustum. You know Marty?
I heard the name, yeah. He's
he was a distributor of low-budget exploitation films. I think he was the guy that financed it. And I don't know what happened to him, but Sam didn't want to hear about it. He hated Marty Rustum, so... Yeah, I'd sure like to find that. I did a great fight in that, one of the best I've ever done. Did a couple of horse falls. I'd just like to see how it turned out.
Dude, I check film prints on eBay and stuff, and nobody's come up with that. I found a one sheet that says Hard Women. It sort of looks like it might be it, but I don't know. Because, you know, those guys used to retitle a lot of this stuff, too.
Yeah. Sam was notorious for that.
Yeah.
Sam Sherman.
Well, if it's the same Marty Rustum I'm thinking of, didn't he distributed Tobe Hooper's Eaten Alive?
I think so.
Yeah,
then it was
released again under six different names.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that was Marty Rustum.
Yeah, that's the same guy. I wonder if he's still around.
I wonder, too. I've been trying to find him on eBay, not on eBay, on Google, and nothing comes up, but... you know, maybe IMDb. I didn't think of that. I should have looked there.
Yeah, because sometimes some of these guys slip through the cracks.
Yeah.
He was big in the 70s and 80s with stuff. I remember that.
Yeah, Marty Rustum and a couple of my good buddies, who you'll remember, Gary Graver and Ron Garcia, cameraman, worked for Marty Rustum a lot. So, yeah, Gary passed away not too long ago. Four years ago, maybe, Gary Graver.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
What a nice guy he was.
Did he make that Wasteland show, that one that you guys were all at? With I think it was you, John Cardos, Bill Smith?
No, he was too sick to get up there. And yet, after that, Gary called me here in Austin. And he came down to Austin. He said he'd been cured of throat cancer. And Gary didn't smoke. He didn't do any of that. But somehow he got throat cancer and had been cured of it, he said. And he was in Austin. And he had just signed a contract with CBS to do three movies of the week. And he was doing this one that he wanted me to take the script and write some stunts for, some really good action sequences. It was about moonshining and the back hills kind of thing. So I took the script and I was working on it, and then the next thing I knew I got a call from his wife who said he's back in the hospital and he's sick again. So the cure evidently he wasn't really cured. And then the next thing I knew, within 4 or 5 months, he was gone.
It sucks.
Yeah. One of those. But we're still here, guys. Damn it, we're still here. We're not going.
Here. So, what do you have? What do you have on tap now? Any projects or anything?
Yeah, let's see. I'm doing some I'm doing some narration for a writer, a sci-fi writer here in Austin named Robert Stickman. So I'm doing the narration for a CD, an audio CD of a story he wrote called Death on the Toilet, which is kind of a very funny story, droll story. So I'm doing that. We're recording it this weekend. And then I have a lead role in a picture called Gun Barrel Highway that they don't have their financing yet, but they're getting close to it, and they'll probably have it going by spring. If they do, I'm playing the meanest son of a bitch that ever came down the pike, which I can't wait to do.
That sounds cool.
Yeah. So I've got that going, and then I have a couple of my own projects that I'm writing. I'm back at that writing thing again, which I enjoy doing. And a thing called Bassett's Body I wrote years ago, a true murder story that my grandmother helped solve. It took place years and years ago, and I wrote the screenplay once, and I won a big award here in Texas for it, but the studios just turned their back on it. And so I thought, well, maybe I need to readdress it and rewrite it a bit and get it out there again, because it's a good story. So I'm working on that and a couple other little things. Keeping the groceries coming in and the animals fed, that's about it.
I hear you on that. You actually wrote and directed another film back in 75, The Pyramid, too, I remember.
Yeah. That's another strange thing. That just resurfaced recently, and I did a DVD on it, and it's been selling like hotcakes. I don't believe it. The Pyramid people keep just appearing out of nowhere, and the people that are into that, it was really a film about consciousness and the cold consciousness movement that went on in the 70s. And late 60s and 70s. But those people, there are more of them now than there were then. So, again, I don't know why, but my work seems to be coming back in vogue for some reason. I don't know.
Hey, you can't knock it. You know, it's you know, long overdue.
I feel anyway. Well, thank you, Pete. Thank you.
Like I say, I wouldn't bullshit anybody. I mean, if I didn't like something somebody did, I'd usually get them on the side and say, look, I'm not going to say nothing about it because I really didn't get into it. But like I said, I know. The whole thing with Rainy Day Friends, my plan was I was going to watch 30 minutes of it, then check something else out I wanted to see. And then, like, after I'm into this for like 15 minutes, I'm like, okay, fuck that other thing. I'm not going nowhere. So.
Oh, man, that's cool. How about Carrie Snodgrass in there?
Oh, she was great. Actually, she reminded me of the nurse that screwed me over.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, she did. I was pissed at her when I started that scene with the whole buzzer thing, and she was just ignoring the whole thing. I was getting pissed.
Yeah.
So it worked.
Good. And then, of course, Janice Rule.
Yes.
What a lady she was in the 40s and 50s. She was big time.
Yeah, I mean, you really lucked out with that cast. That was a great cast.
It was a good cast, and I did luck out. You're right. Well, I hope people order it and take a look at it. Again, it's on my website, GaryWarnerKent.com, and they'll get a chance to see a really good film, I think.
Yeah, and don't none of you bastards download it and not pay for it either. I don't want to hear that shit.
Yeah. Me either, man. What is that? They're just music, books, the whole thing. They're just
being stolen.
That's what killed
me. That's what killed me. Oh, yeah. It's like I went from doing good to doing horrible. It's part of the reason I had to go back to Jersey anyway. I had to sit down with the office about, you know, what I was putting out, because I'm not making any money on it. Is it worth doing any more of it if this is what's happening? And basically, they're stealing it. I got loud about it. Todd can verify this. I went after, you know, one guy on the air and cursed him out, and it just encouraged him to do it even more.
Wow.
And then people that said, oh, we wouldn't download your shit. Yeah, you are. So I dropped off a couple of message boards I was contributing to, because it's all bullshit. You know, they don't want to pay for it.
Yeah. I know. It's just a shame. I don't know why, but they're doing it.
It's this weird mentality that everybody thinks, you know, a certain segment of the population thinks that all media should be free. Well,
yeah.
I said, well, you know, basically you succeeded because you made me stop doing what I'm doing, and I'm not going to do anymore until it's advantageous for me to do so. But think if everybody starts thinking like me and says, you know something, if I'm going to do something to get fucked over and not get paid, There ain't going to be no new product on the market, guys. That's the bottom line.
Yeah, yeah.
Not that what's out there is exciting anyway, but, you know.
No, I hear you. I hear you.
It's like, you know, that's why I appreciate this film so much, because it gives me a chance to rediscover something I probably would have passed up. You know, I probably would have passed up L.A. I remember seeing the title L.A. Bad, but it didn't seem like to be something I would have, you know, wanted to see back then. But now, you
yeah.
know.
Yeah, terrible title, L.A. Bad. But Rainy Day Friends fits the situation, I think, much more. So. And that was the original title.
Yeah, and you know what it is too. A lot of times your viewing habits change. You know, you just you're in one. As you get older, like I said, you know, like I said, you know, I appreciate a lot of the 50s and 60s horror films, because you know a lot of things I was just looking for monsters, and I was never looking for anything more cerebral. But now right, I go back right. on some of this other thing. There was some pretty cerebral films back then.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely. They were, like you said, that really scared you and really caught you. And today, some of these things, I'm not scared at all. I mean, what's the deal? What's the excitement? But some of those things, remember The Thing when it first came out, the original Thing?
Oh, yeah. Man, I was a kid. I saw it on TV. It scared the crap out of me.
Me too.
There's another one, The Crawling Eye. Remember that one?
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there was something that was like, I don't know if, you know, okay, you're basically a West Coast guy. We had something out here called Million Dollar Movie, where they ran the same movie every night at the same time for like 7 days straight. And it was like, you'd watch The Crawling Eye or House on Haunted Hill or something like that to a certain point where you got scared, you'd turn it off, and the next night you'd get up to that part and see if you get past it again. Maybe you made it till Saturday when you were a kid.
Yeah, wow, that's great, yeah.
Yeah, I had an idea, maybe in the future, Gary, we should get like you, maybe John Cardos and another guy who worked with the biker stuff, and have like the original Sons of Anarchy on or something.
Oh, man, that would be great.
Yeah, I mean, if you're in touch with John or anybody, yeah, that'd be cool.
Yeah, he'd love to do it. He'd love to do it.
Oh, great. Well, as Todd says, we're running out of time, so I thank you very much for coming on. It's always a pleasure, and you know, I urge people to go out and check out Rainy Day Friends, and I'm definitely sure we're going to have you back on. So,
well, thank you so much, Pete and Todd. You guys are great, and I appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Oh, you're welcome, bro.
Good deal.
Oh, my pleasure. Great talking to you. Great having you on, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you. Take care.
Good night. Okay, I want to thank Gary again for being on, and next week's going to be a mystery. We don't know what the fuck we're going to do. We might even go live, but until then, stay sick, and we'll see you then.
ticket window for a mere $3.50. That's your ticket to an all-night, 24/7 evening at the Grindhouse. You want spaghetti westerns? How about the man with no name? Django. Yeah, they're all in here. How about some bikers like the Hell's Angels, Satan Slaves, Satan Sadists? You want some blood and guts? Well, how about H.G. Lewis, Andy Milligan, John Carpenter, George A. Romero, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the Ghastly Ones, Ilsa, She-Wolf of the SS, all those hot, horny mistresses guaranteed to dominate your dreams. They're all yours right here in the Grindhouse.
So grab yourself a seat on Saturday.